territory. I want to begin just by raising the question, why are we here? Why are we here in this church, in this city? But no organization can exist long in a place except that it feels that it has a right to be there. Okay? So if you're living as a Christian in New York City, you can't be coming into church kind of wondering, am I doing something wrong here? And looking over your shoulder saying, is this legal? You know, and it's against the civil laws of New York City or something like that. You can't go on like that. You know, and if you get over that, you can't come into the church and see it as only this sport that you come into and collapse, a place to be shielded from the sharp points of the city. It certainly is that, and we are that, but we can't be only that. We can't be this place just simply to be shielded from. Because if we're that, then we shall not long be here. So why are we here? It's rather a basic question. Why are we here? Okay. And in this passage, John tells us why there should be a church in Greenwich Village. Now, I want to give you his reason. I want to give you at least one reason for saying, you know, I'm a Christian. I'm in this church. My church is here, and it belongs here. Okay? That's what I want to do. So let's start. Let me start first by saying why we can't say that we belong here. A lot of Christian organizations and churches around the world can now say, you know, the place where we are has a Christian heritage. Okay? Especially in America, you know, a lot of places can say, you know, our forefathers came here to escape religious persecution or to found a colony under God. We have a Christian heritage here. We belong here, you know. I love what a certain minister in our denomination, Preston Graham, is doing up in New Haven next to Yale University. He's building a church, physical church building, right next to the campus. This is astounding, folks, because a church hasn't been built in New Haven in over 100 years. He's building it right next to the campus, and that church is going to have a presence on Yale University campus. And to those who think that's odd, he can say, and he does say, hey, you know, we belong here. Yale was formed and founded to train ministers, right? And has tremendous Christian heritage. Just look at the names of the residential colleges, Jonathan Edwards, Bishop Berkeley, tremendous Christian heritage. And even if the university has departed from its original mandate, it's certainly not about preaching the gospel anymore. At least the people who are on campus preaching the gospel can stake a claim to being there. Right? We have this heritage. Well, we can say no such thing about New York City. Okay? New Amsterdam was founded to make money. That's why people came here from the very beginning. New Amsterdam was a colony owned and operated by a corporation, a very large corporation. And the reason they came here, these Belgian, you know, French-speaking merchants and Dutch-speaking merchants and outcasts, they came here to make a guilder from beaver skins. That's what it was about. So we can't really come in here and say, you know, look at the founding of New York City. You know, it was decadent. The morality was terrible here. There was filth and rank in the streets. You know, when Peter Stuyvesant got here, there was one tavern for every 20 men. That's really the state of things. So we cannot boast of our prominent religious heritage, because there wasn't one. And we could say, sure, there are some people, some of the figures in the history of New York have been men and women of faith. I mean, specifically of Greenwich Village, I'm thinking of Dorothy Day, that comes to mind. But really, they're just figures in the history. The secular nature of the first settlement has cast its karma over the entire history. Its influence still pervades today. People came here for success, and they're still coming here for success now, hundreds of years later. But, there was something else that came over with that European settlement in those Dutch West Indian Company ships. And that was, if, to put it simply, a spirit, a radical spirit of nonconformism. Okay? Simply stated, it was a discontentment with the way things are. Okay? A belief that something is awry with the way that things are. Something's wrong. So it's a suspicion of the matrix. Okay? And often accompanying that, a deep belief that what is needed is not just reform, but something like revolution to bring in a new order. That has been a driving spirit of New York City from its European beginning, perhaps even earlier than that, though not a lot of information comes down to us about the Lenape Native Americans that were here. But I would argue that this revolutionary spirit, this radical impetus, has played just as large a role in making New York as the commercial enterprise, I would argue that. And this spirit took up residence, it concentrated itself specifically in none other than the rolling hills of Green Village. Even back when Green Village was hills of hemlock and fir and oak, as it used to be, with wild game filling the woods, and it was where people got away from the city. It was to go up north to get away for a while. Way back then, even back then, you could see the spirit exerting itself in the residents who lived here. So I want to give you two examples, because this is really what the village is, and you can see it in many ways. Poor guys could go on and on. Let me just give you two examples. Okay? In 1811, the population of New York City was 80,000 people. And the city planners got together and realized there was tremendous expansion going on. They realized what they really want to do is organize the streets. And so in 1811, they came up with a plan to impose upon the entire island the famous grid of 12 avenues across, 150 cross streets. And they did so. They enacted that on the island back then. Except when they came to Greenwich Village, what happened, the people rose up in vociferous protest, okay? The streets of Green Village, they followed the ancient cow path, all different directions. Changed directions all the time, sound familiar? The addresses on the buildings, on the houses, changed numbering in mid-street, you know? And the residents of Green Village rose up and said, and we like it that way, you know? And so the city planners, when they got to Greenwich Village, you know, their city planners are generally peace-loving individuals, like Eric de Kock. Where is he over here? And Eric, you know, this was a city planner's nightmare, okay? And they were just, the city planners were no match for the residents of Greenwich Village. The grid bypassed Greenwich Village, and that is why, folks, if you go outside church this morning and turn left, the first thing you'll see is West 4th Street crossing West 11th Street. That's why. Because Greenwich Village is about resistance to the grid. It always has been. Okay, second example. 100 years later, Max Eastman becomes the editor of The Masses, okay, the socialist magazine. And those of you who kind of are in journalism, you know that, you know, The Masses was arguably one of the most influential shapers of journalism in this country. Okay. And when they founded it, especially when Max Eastman became the editor, his whole goal was, he did not want the magazine to become just a tool of socialism. And if you read the manifesto, and I've quoted it there in the beginning of your bulletin, it gives you a taste of how Max Eastman was not interested in this magazine becoming a tool of socialism or of capitalism. What they existed to do, and it was made up of Greenwich Village folk, is to challenge all conventions. And it was really about putting the search for truth above an ideology. That's what they were about. It was to try to challenge all conventions because of a discontentment with the way things were. Okay? And folks, that is why we should have a church in Greenwich Village. Because a Christian is someone who says, first of all, that there is something wrong. That things are not right with the present order of the world. They're bothered by the matrix. Okay? And if you don't think that there's anything wrong, you cannot be a Christian. Sorry. Prerequisite. You have got to be bothered. You must suspect that things are awry. Now, if you look at verses 43 through 45 here, it sounds like a simple story of one who told, you know, who told who, and Philip told Nathaniel, and so forth. But in this scurrying about of the original apostles, there's really a profound paradigm shift that's going on. Okay, these men are bothered by the present order of things. They recognized that there needed to be not just a fix to society, not just a repairing, but a revolution of messianic proportions. So what Philip is referring to here, he talked about the one Moses wrote about. What Philip means is that Moses brought in a lot of good, and Moses knew it. Moses knew that. But Moses also knew that it wasn't really a fix. Moses knew all along, you see, that there needed to be a more violent solution to the problem of evils in the world. So Moses wrote about the need, that there needed to come one who would completely redo things, a greater prophet that would stagger our comprehension. And the prophets, in short, following Moses, said pretty much the same thing, only they made it cosmic, the revolution. Messiah means revolution. And it's only discussed among people who hold that something is very wrong with the world, desperately wrong. Such are the people John is discussing here, Philip and Andrew and Nathaniel. They knew the need for a revolution. What's surprising here is this phrase that Philip uses, the one that Moses wrote about, quote unquote. You know, that didn't roll off an Israelite's tongue very easily. There had been a dismal, dismal ending to the kingdom of God on earth a long, long time ago. And there had been 400 years of prophetic silence. Biblical events were a fading memory. Nobody really knew what was going on in Israel. And it was hard in Israel in those times to believe in anything. Such was the state of things, which is why Nathanael greets Philip with obvious skepticism about this Messiah. And if you're chuckling over Nathanael's answer, you know, can anything good come out of Nazareth? You should. The author means you to, while he shows you what kind of person Nathanael Bartholomew was. Nathanael Bartholomew is his surname. This apostle, from what we can piece together, was from a family of nonconformist ilk. The reason I say this is because his family may very well have been of nobility, possibly Egyptian nobility, the Ptolemy family. And yet here he was, joined to Israel. And then Eusebius cites this apostle as later turning up as a missionary in India, of all places. So based on what we seem to know about this guy's origin and his destination, this was a guy ready for adventure. And I think we can conclude in his, you know, from his concluding words about Jesus, you know, that Jesus, Son of God, King of Israel, as he's drawing out the implications of what he's experiencing, that Nat was a thinker of larger issues. He understood what was happening in Jesus' mission, not only as the return of the ancient King of Israel, which was big enough, but also as something much more cosmic, the coming of the Son of God. So he was a thinker, and that was a non-conforming revolutionary, a skeptic. Okay? And we should note here, please note with me, that Jesus does not seem to be afraid of or condemning a skepticism. In fact, he seems to rejoice over it in Nathanael. Right? He's so excited about Nathanael, he introduces him from afar. Okay? I mean, there's hardly anybody that we can read about to whom Jesus gives such an introduction. Yeah, an Israelite in whom there is no guile. I mean, that must mean that Jesus was not put off by Nathanael's skepticism, right? He welcomed it. Now, this would be a good time to say, just as Alan was saying, what we're going to do here, in right from the beginning of version 3.0 of the Lister, is introduce a question and answer period after the service. We're going to break for 10 minutes, and then who's ever interested in asking a question about the sermon, rose in your mind, you know, what about this, you know, how can you say this? We're going to meet toward the back of the auditorium, whoever wants to, and you can ask questions, and I'll be responding to them. Or, you know, if you just kind of wandered in here, you went out this morning and got your paper, and you just happened to end up in here, and you're wondering, what is this Christianity stuff? That can be a time for you, too, you can ask anything, question you have about the Bible or about Christianity. I never understood this. That would be questions. We'll be fielding those as well. Now, we're going to try that out today. If nobody shows up, I'll go down and have a bagel. But we want to give you the opportunity to do it. Why are we doing it? Because Jesus rejoiced over Nathanael. That's why. He welcomed it. He welcomed those questions. He welcomed that skepticism. Now, we should note that Jesus welcomed this because it was a certain kind of skepticism. Now, I was recently at a party. I was speaking with an atheist, and he said to me, you know, I'm a skeptic, not a cynic. I said, okay, skeptic, cynic, what's the difference? And he said, a cynic is somebody who's committed to his unbelief. A skeptic is someone who's open to be taught, yet. That's what he said. I said, well, let me try to convert you. So I said to myself, now, here's a Nathanael, okay? This is what Nathanael was like. He's a skeptic. But notice, when Philip says in verse 46, come and see, he goes. He goes. In fact, that speaks volumes. Nathanael is willing to check it out, to investigate this dubious Nazareth phenomenon. And Jesus rejoices in this kind of person. Okay, that's what he says in verse 47. What makes a true Israelite is not ethnicity, which might have been an issue in John's audience, why he's reporting this story, not ethnicity, but this kind of sincerity that Nat has in his search for the truth, not having guile. That's what Nathanael had, a sincerity in seeking truth, a willingness to put the search for truth over convention, even over his ideology, even over his sociological views concerning Nazareth. Now, I hope that, in bringing this out, I hope that I'm pressing you to reconsider the kind of people that Jesus gathered around himself. Okay? At least two of the apostles we know, at least two, were zealots. Zealots, both. And these were revolutionaries ready to die for freedom. And they believed with all their hearts that submission to Rome in any area was high treason against God, because God was supposed to be the true king of Israel. That's what they believed. And these people, and they were scary. Okay, some of them were terrorists. Okay, they would be the people that we would avoid. Okay, they weren't just protesters. They were dangerous. Jesus chose at least two of them to be his apostles. Get this? Do you get this? And when he got finished with them, well, they were no more anarchists, but they were still radicals. So you must realize that the people that Jesus gathered around him were original Greenwich Village type people. In a sense that they were convinced of the need for real revolution. They were skeptics in confusing times, but they were ones that were open to investigating radical solutions. Okay, that's the village, the East Village of Williamsburg. Now, this characteristic of Jesus is why, in the last 2,000 years, many different revolutionary movements have been able to tether their work to him. Jesus is claimed as a model for many movements that he would certainly not support in person if present. But it can work because he is a revolutionary of sorts. Okay, he gathered revolutionaries around him. So let's go with Nathanael here in verses 47 to 49 and investigate this Messiah. Let's go with him to investigate. See what he finds. What does he find? He finds an expressly personal encounter. Okay, what he says in verse 18 is, Jesus says this to him about the fig tree. He says, how do you know anything about me when we've never met? And Jesus says, in essence, oh, but we have met, Nathanael, in your prayers. Now, you say, well, what's this business about the fig tree? Well, we aren't told what the significance of the fig tree is, and that is the point. We don't know. Only Nathanael does. This is about something between God and Nathanael that only they know. That's why Nathanael drops to his knees before Jesus. Because only God could have known what that experience under the fig tree meant to Nathanael. So what we see happen here, and it happens, you know, happens many times when skeptics openly seek the truth in Jesus, is that they get more than their questions answered. They get a personal experience of Jesus Christ. They get more than they bargained for. It often happens. You see, John is showing us that for people who are looking for a revolution, the revolution must infiltrate their personal life. Do you want to be radical? Do you want to be radical? I said, do you want to be radical? How radical? How radical are you willing to be? How about respecting your truth, respecting the search for truth over your ideology? Now that's radical. Are you willing to be radical enough to let the pursuit of what is true affect your political doctrine? How radical? How about letting the truth affect your sex life? Okay. Many people will talk religious ideas with you, and that's fine, but don't mess with my sexual emancipation. Okay. If you let that line get crossed, then you're being radical. Really radical. How radical? How about allowing the truth to change your personal life, infiltrate your personal decisions? See, folks, the problem is not with radicals here being radical. The problem with the radicals not being radical enough. Jesus' revolution leads people to an encounter so personal that they're willing to be countercultural to the point of loss, if that's where the truth will lead you. And in that case, it was to go and die in India. Now, let me just pause right here at this moment. To those of you, when I said, do you want to be radical? Inside you said, well, no. Not really. I know that there might be some people here who are listening to this and probably thinking, you know, this sounds a little unsettling to me. I'm not really a radical type. You know, I work in human resources. You know? Or, you know, I'm an accountant. Something like that. So let me be very clear about what I mean here. Okay? The Village Church has a rap about being an artist church. Okay, it's a church full of artists. You know, not really. We have a good number of arts professionals here because we are so blessed to have the international arts movement living here. And a lot of people come to this church through interacting with that ministry and come in. And so it provides a locus of fellowship here. That's true. But if you actually look at the vocational demographics of you, and we have, to actually find that there are other clumps in this church. Okay, there's administrators here, there are moms here, there are technical people here, there are financial people here, there are social workers, teachers. There are also people who, as far as you can tell, don't do anything at all in this church. There are all sorts here. It's much more diverse than you think. And besides, we had better not be a church full of artists or we'll go bankrupt. But seriously, what I really don't want is for, if you're here, you think, you know, I'm not the creative type. Do I belong here? Okay? The radical countercultural quality of the informed Christian life, it doesn't come from a certain type of personality, a certain type of job, or a certain type of fashion. It comes from a certain type of faith. Okay? You don't need to be an artist to be in this church. But to be in this church, you do need to agree that there's something desperately wrong with the world. You do need to be skeptical of false messiahs. And you do need to be open to new experience. These are the first things Christianity is about in this culture. And that is why there's a church in Greenwich Village, folks. That's why we need to be here. That's what we need. Now, that's not all we need. Okay, these are necessary but not sufficient. As we go on to the last two verses, Jesus tells us that. And if you look at verse 15 and 51, Nathanael is deeply convicted by his divine encounter as the revolution enters his personal life. So he drops to his knees. Okay? But you know what? Jesus tells us that that is not enough. even having a personal experience with the divine does not you a Christian make. Please see this. Okay? Just because you had a personal encounter with God doesn't make you a Christian. That's what Jesus means when he says that there's something greater on which to base Nathanael's faith. You see that? He says, you believe because of this personal encounter? Well, that's good. That's a good start, Nathanael. You know, I am about giving you an existentially alive spirituality, even if you are a Presbyterian, Nathanael. Yes, I'm about that. But there's something greater that you need to see to base your faith on, and I'm going to show it to you. Now, what's the greater thing that Nathanael is going to see? It's a little cryptic here. We need to say what Nathanael is going to be given here by Jesus is an interpretation. You see, Nathanael needs something to interpret his personal encounter, his personal experience. Otherwise, you know, who knows what our personal experiences mean, right? I mean, so what? So we have a fig tree experience that knocks us over. Okay, so what? How do we tell what that means? So Jesus gives him an interpretation. He has shown, Nathanael is, how his personal experience was possible. And the interpretation is to bring him to see himself and Jesus in a new way. And in verse 51 here, Jesus is making a definite reference to the dream of the Old Testament patriarch Jacob. He talks about ascending and descending angels in heaven being opened up like that. And, you know, we don't know the scriptures, so we lose Jesus at this point. But let me just briefly recount to you the story so we can see why Jesus cites Jacob. Jacob was an Old Testament patriarch who was an absolute cad. Okay? He was deceptive. He was conniving. He was manipulative. It got him into serious trouble to the point that he was on the run from his brother who wanted to kill him. Okay, that's what was going on. There's nothing exemplary about this patriarch, Jacob. He was rebellious. He made a complete mess of his life. Complete mess. And he came to the absolute lowest point in his life, right at this moment that Jesus is quoting. Okay? He had lost everything. He was fleeing for his life. He was outside on the ground for the night. Okay? He didn't even have enough to make a pillow. He didn't have enough stuff with him to make a pillow. He had to use a stone for a pillow. That's how low he was. Absolute rock bottom. Sorry, I didn't mean that. He was at the absolute bottom of his life. You see, it was at this point, when he fell asleep on the ground, the extreme lowest point in his life, God chose that moment to give him a dream in which he shows Jacob a stairway to heaven. In so doing, see, he was giving Jacob to understand that there was nothing in himself to warrant it. But despite that, God was going to make the way for him to heaven. Jacob sees angels going up and down. In other words, he sees a connection to the new order, to the utopia, the place of perfection. And God was choosing him, cad as he was, to take it. So when Jesus makes reference to this dream, of course, this goes right through Nathanael's head in 2 seconds. But when he makes reference to this dream, he's really meaning two things. He means, first of all, that Nathanael needs to change his view about the location of the villain. He means, first of all, the location of the villain is within the human heart. See, because there was nothing exemplary in Jacob's life to warrant utopia, but God was giving it to him. So when Jesus says, you will see, he's telling Nathanael Bartholomew that really he's got to see himself as a Jacob. He's got to see himself as a Jacob, unworthy but chosen to refuse a dream, to be in this revolution. And you see, the way that Jesus connects Nathanael to the larger revolution that God is carrying out shows us the difference between Christians and other radicals that may populate the village, or East Village, or Williamsburg. The difference between Christians and other radicals is not often in the recognition of the evil. It's in the locating of the source of the evil. So you need to locate the evil that you're rebelling against in the right place. And many radicals understand, you know, injustice and oppression, problems in traditional relationships, but then they locate the evil in non-ultimate institutions. Okay, the villain, they say, is capitalism. The villain is marriage. Or the real villain is some sociological development, or the media, you know, or the real villain is the political machine. In fighting Jacob, Jesus is saying, no, these are, even when they're at their worst, only henchmen. The real villain to rebel against is located in the human heart. Or as John Lennon put it, you better free your mind instead. Okay? Christ would probably have said, you better let me free your mind first, so you can be useful to the revolution. I mean, the problem runs across both the nonconformist and the suit. And secondly in this, he's saying that he himself, Jesus Christ, is that stairway to heaven. And you'll see Jacob ascending and descending angels, ascending and descending on me. See that? He himself is the means by which we make our way to the new order. See, the revolution is completely different than what you expected, Zealous. The revolution is accomplished by making me the stairway to heaven. Earlier we said Messiah means revolution. Jesus is insisting here that revolution means Messiah. I am the revolution. You must connect your personal experience with the larger rebellion that God is carrying out against the current order. And that connection can only be made, Nathaniel, in me. So as we are come to the table now, I want you to think about that. Jesus is saying he is the ladder to the new life. He's what you need to fight for. He's the stairway to heaven by which you can have a divine experience that brings you into the revolution. And folks, this is a revolution that's going to succeed. That's why the Village Church needs to be in Greenwich Village. And that's why these members who we just received have joined this revolution. How about you? Let's come to the table.